You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
The Team Never Quit podcast is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. If you're looking for a car this summer, go check out how Navy Federal and TrueCar are making it so easy for you to find the right one at NavyFederal.org.
What we need to do is reorient the whole system towards employment and towards thriving and towards change its goals from seeing how much money people can get to see how good of outcomes they can get.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you guys for listening and watching, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button wherever you're getting this show. So today, before we get to our special guest, let's kick it off with our weekly Patreon question. And this week, we've got, what is your most controversial food, your favorite food, item that is controversial that is not pineapple on pizzas?
Mm. Oh, what do you add to?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like a mix.
Or just a type of food that people think that is just absolutely disgusting that you're always willing to try.
I think mine, which I find it very surprising that people think it's gross, but I grew up eating it like this, so I think it's normal, but I eat ketchup on my eggs.
What?
Yeah. Like, I have to have eggs with, I have to have ketchup with scrambled eggs. Yeah. I can't eat scrambled eggs without ketchup.
What about you, brother?
You know, I love cilantro. I love cilantro and everything, but I know there's like 20% of the population that says it tastes like soap when they eat it. Mm-hmm. So it's some kind of genetic, I would say a deformity in those people, but I think cilantro is great, but so some people hate it, but I love it.
I like to put ranch dressing in my chili.
Ew. Really?
Yeah, with cheese. Yeah.
It works. Kind of like a cheesy, almost like a good mouthfeel to it.
Yeah, it was an accident in the beginning, as most good food combinations are.
I don't know. You've done some wild food combinations.
Yeah. And sour cream on my cinnamon toast, which you actually think is good.
No, cream cheese.
Cream cheese, excuse me. Not sorry. Cream cheese on my cinnamon toast. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be really good.
I could get behind that. That sounds good.
Yeah, it is. What about you, buddy?
I'd probably say I love to try any kind of grimy street food that I can find.
Street meat?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you ate bugs and stuff in Peru.
I've done that in Peru, Vietnam, Japan. I'll try anything if they got a street vendor selling it.
Have you ever had a balut egg?
No. What is it?
I did.
What's a balut?
Where the duck is still, where you peel the egg.
Oh, and, no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the one thing when people ask about freak food, and I wouldn't get into that. That's one of them. I remember when Rogan had this show called Fear Factor. Remember that when we were younger?
Yeah.
That big thing was feeding them funky stuff, and that one always kind of got me.
I was in Korea last week, and I asked the guy who was taking us around whether he could find a place for us to eat dog, because I'd absolutely eat dog. I just haven't.
Ew.
Would you eat dog in Korea?
No. No, that's so on the list of never to touch.
Hands down.
No. So it's not like your regular Labrador, because they have, I was stationed there.
Thank God.
They have this special kind of dog. And I don't remember what name it is, but it looks like a white kind of husky looking dog with a curly tail.
No.
And they actually have like dog farms out in the country. Like you'll see like dog cages and the whole deal. And they're
you're going.
I think
I'm going to do you a favor and say, don't ever try that.
And don't ever
well,
talk
I haven't
about
yet.
It.
I haven't yet, but I
don't
think
ever
I would.
Bring it
just
up again.
Okay.
That is.
I never even heard of that.
Awful.
Is that
You've
real?
Never heard of people eating dog? Absolutely, it is.
No.
Yeah, totally.
That actually makes my stomach really turn over.
Oh, that's funny. Wow, you guys are really sensitive to that. I would. I mean, I didn't, and I haven't, but I would, because Koreans do it, and I like Koreans, and so it's probably good food. I don't know.
I like Koreans too, but I'm going to strongly disagree with
eating
dogs.
I'm going to have to go
dogs.
Vegan.
Yeah.
I'd have to go vegan. I'll eat some lettuce on that one, man. I hadn't heard of that one.
Yeah.
I think it's culturally fading out, which is obviously something that makes you both very happy. But I know older people do it, and I don't think people our age really and younger are.
I can imagine back
dogs.
In the day when stuff was real bad over there and they didn't have anything to eat during the famines and everything, how that probably came online. That's the same way when you hear about people eating horses.
That's also a hard no for me.
Yeah, horse mm-hmm. meat.
Yeah, now, horses are cool. I've not thought about eating one, though. No thanks.
Yeah.
I guess there's that's kind of like my great-grandma used to make squirrel gumbo. I mean, some people would just freak out with the thought of eating a squirrel.
Well, that was a good question. All right, brother. Thanks for doing this, man. Thanks for coming on. I like to introduce you to the team. The way we do that, I like to get into your backstory a little bit and find out where you're from, and then we'll kind of go from there. So please, if you wouldn't mind, tell me where you grew up.
Yeah, great. So I grew up in Minot, North Dakota, which is a tiny little city. It's not tiny, about 40,000 people, north central North Dakota. Grew up there. It's a great place to grow up. We had a little farm. My parents were school teachers, but we had this little tiny farm out in the countryside. And so I just grew up sort of barefoot in the summertime and wearing a heavy coat in the winter and hunting and, hanging out. It was a great place to grow up.
How'd y'all wind up getting up there? Was it from your grandparents or do your parents maybe all up there?
No. So my dad was an infantry soldier in Vietnam. It's kind of a funny story. He was drafted when he was like 24, 25. He was already a college graduate and he was a school teacher. And he got drafted. So he went to Vietnam and spent 2 years in the army and was in Vietnam August 68 to August 69. And then he got out of Vietnam, married my mom the next spring. And then this is, obviously before job boards on the internet or anything like that. And so he got this teaching job in North Dakota and he promised my mom that they'd be there for like a year or two max. And then they would go to Colorado. And, 40 some years later, he died in North Dakota. They raised our family of five children in North Dakota. And that's where home was until I went into the Army.
That's what I was going to ask you about your siblings. I mean, you have four siblings?
Yeah, two older, two younger. Older brother graduated from West Point a couple years ahead of me. Little brother did not go to West Point, but he did go in the Army. So All three of the brothers served in the Army, and the sisters. My older sister actually works for an organization called CRU, which is like campus ministry. And then my little sister lives in Florida now, and she and her husband they foster kids, and I mean they're everybody. It's cool because everybody in our family has some kind of service. It's different kinds, but it's all about kind of giving back, and I think that's really neat, and it says something about my parents.
Oh, so you got some kick-ass parents.
Yeah, totally. I had great parents. Absolutely.
Sounds like about the old man was happy that y'all got into West Point. And is the younger one enlisted?
He was enlisted, yeah. He was a sniper in the Yeah. Well, so, you know, I don't know for him. He was 14 years younger than me. So I was already, let me see, I had already gone to Iraq and gotten blown up and all that stuff before he even joined the Army. So he went in with, I'd say, clear eyes about what that life was going to be like. And he just did one enlistment. I think he was in, I want to say 3 or 4 years, something like that. And he was an infantry soldier in I Corps LRS out at Fort Lewis, Washington. So yeah, he took a big bite. He went to Iraq, but it was kind of after the lights were turned off, and I don't think he saw any action there. But he certainly was willing to raise his right hand, and that's something I think that's valuable, you know.
Oh, we have the young ones that are coming up now, going into the military, and if you don't have any idea what you want to do when you get out of high school, going to the military. It's basically a university. They pay for you. They feed you. You're going to make advancement. When you get out, you usually have a clearance and you have that veteran tag. And that's huge in the United States as soon as someone hears that about you.
Yeah, we're steering the younger ones that are just graduating high school and even just graduating college. We're like, all right.
Even if you want to stay in there for 20 years and climb the ranks, you can still get out and get a great job. It'll be waiting on you.
That's right. Yeah, I do worry, though. I don't know if you guys worry about this, but like, I worry about whether, you know, the wars that we fought in, you know, were they the right thing to do? You know, the war in Iraq, you know, I think all of us have big questions about that one. The war in Afghanistan, I think we had to do, although I don't necessarily love the way we did it in some ways, especially the withdrawal. But it's like, I wonder if our national leadership is courageous enough to understand that these young men and women, their blood should not be sacrificed in vain. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like sometimes these kids get thrown to the wolves or they get thrown into wars that are for the wrong reasons. Yeah. I mean, Vietnam is a great example of it, but you know, you could say kind of the same thing about some of the stuff we saw, don't you think?
Well, I think it started with them because the people who were in Vietnam were the ones that sent us into our wars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're the leadership now. That's the baby boomers.
Or the people who dodged Vietnam were the one who sent us into wars.
It's mostly the people that dodged Vietnam.
Well, and with us, the withdrawal was terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way around that.
The good news is I think that our generation, I hope our generation, as we come into sort of leadership in society, you know, your brother in Congress and people like that in Congress and elsewhere, hopefully we'll do a better job about deciding when and where to go to war and making sure it's in our vital national interest before we do it rather than just going off willy-nilly.
I think we do. I think we will. For whatever reason, those two wars, and before we even got into our wars, the way we were raised, like latchkey kids, the MTV generation, no one thought we were going to do anything. No one thought we were going to make it. But then we had to go through the pandemics. We had to go through the housing crisis, 9/11, two wars.
Yeah. I'm in a little group text with some of the guys I went to war with, and you know, we don't see each other in person all that often, maybe once every other year or something like that. But every couple of days, there's like a little group text thing. And I think that does a good job of helping us, you know, like if one of us was struggling, I think that we could jump in and be, you know, and say to our friend, like, hey, man, you know, come visit me. Let me come visit you. I'll jump on a plane right now. So the more you can connect with people, I think the more valuable, you know, that's really valuable. It's really important.
So when did you go in?
So I enlisted in 92, joined the Army as a private in the Army Reserve in 92. And I'll just say this in front of your audience. I actually did that primarily because I wanted to go to West Point. I knew I wanted to go to West Point, but I didn't have the grades as a freshman in high school, especially. I had bad, like 3.0, and that wasn't going to be good enough. And so I enlisted because there's another route to sort of get into the academy that way. And then this is funny, but when I was at basic training between my junior and senior year of high school, I found out I'd done really well on the SAT. And so it was like, oh no, I don't even really need to be here. I could have gone straight in. But anyway, so then after I graduated from high school, I went off to West Point and graduated from West Point in 97. So my time as an enlisted soldier was only for like a year in the Army Reserve. And I went to basic training. And then the next summer, I was supposed to go to my advanced training. But the other thought was similar to what you're saying earlier about like if you don't have a purpose after you graduate from high school. My thought was, okay, if I'm going to have to, my parents didn't have any money. So my thought was, if I'm going to have to work my way through college anyway, then having the Army Reserve pay would be great. And I enlisted as a medic. So I knew I could go out and get an EMT certification and then maybe like ride ambulances on the weekends or whatever to pay for my college. And that was kind of the plan. But then when I got into West Point, of course, that's a full scholarship for everybody. So I didn't have to work in that sense through college. And then I graduated from West Point in 97. And of course, you know, if you remember back in the old days, you know, 97, right? Like nothing was going on, right? The Gulf had happened earlier and there was, you know, the stuff in Somalia was over and the stuff in Kosovo and Bosnia hadn't really kicked off in terms of American involvement yet. So it was kind of like a sleepy time for the armed services, not really knowing that, you know, 9/11 was just around the corner and the world would change for all of us at that point.
I feel like late 90s, because that's when I started training for it to go in. It's like, there's nothing going on. I remember hearing that from a lot of people. Like, why would you go in? There's nothing going on. I'm like, you know, it's just kind of a service mentality. Mm-hmm. But 9/11 definitely was running around the corner. Where'd they send you?
Well, so I was an armor officer. So that means, you know, that's tanks in the Army. And I know you know that, but I'm just telling your audience that's tanks. So I was an armor officer, and I was first at Fort Carson, Colorado. And then after my time at Fort Carson, I left Fort Carson in 2000 and went to Marine Amphibious Warfare School for my, you know, advanced course training with a bunch of Marine captains. I was an Army exchange student with a bunch of Marines, which was really fun. And then
a good time.
Oh, it was a great time. Yeah, it was a great time. The Marines are great. I mean, like the culture of physical fitness among Marine officers is something that I think would really benefit the Army. And then that was right when the Marine Corps combatives program had just started. And so that was something that we got to do that was fun. But then after that, before my next assignment, I went to Ranger School, and I had actually just started Ranger School on September 10th.
Oh, wow.
Monday, September 10th, I started Ranger School. And then when the next day, when the towers got attacked, we all thought that it was like part of the road to war, you know, the scenario is like the training scenario. And so only later that day did they tell us that it was real and that, you know, our country was at war and all that stuff. And it was, that was wild being at Ranger School, during all that initial invasion stuff. And it was funny because I was in mountain phase when the jump into Afghanistan happened on October 17th of that year, when, I think it was 3rd Ranger Battalion jumped in. And so like all the guys who were assigned to 3rd Ranger Battalion, but who were at Ranger School with me were so mad because they felt like they had missed the war and they'd missed the combat jump and all that stuff. So I was at Ranger School on 9/11, which is kind of a funny thing. One thing that's interesting is that like everybody else in the world, I think, like saw the towers come down like 500 times the first day and then watched it repeatedly for weeks and weeks and weeks. But I didn't see the towers come down. I didn't see the video of it until November after I graduated from school.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy, huh?
I remember when that jump went down because that was the first combat jump in a while.
That's right. Yeah.
I remember that being a big deal.
Yeah. They jumped into some guys had jumped into Panama,
right?
And some guys had jumped into Grenada, you know, in 83, but that was the first jump. And then there were a couple more. There were several more after that. Cause some guys jumped into Iraq later during the invasion.
Yeah.
And then there's been quite a few special operator jumps, some combat jumps from SEALs and so forth, as you well know.
Right, I was talking about the static line.
Yeah. That would have been crazy. Man, can you imagine?
Yesterday was Memorial Day, so we were watching Band of Brothers all day. Mm-hmm. And what those guys were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those guys were
freaking mass amazing, exits, bro.
Dude. Pretty rough.
Oh, my God. I don't know who came up with that idea, man, but it's crazy when you throw that many people out in the sky.
Yeah, you fill the sky with guys and hope for the best.
Hope for the best.
It's wild.
That's the mentality.
Yeah.
And you can't drive those chutes or anything, man. It's just kind of like where you land.
Yeah. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. I remember when 9/11 went down, all the instructors were wanting to leave because they were afraid they were going to miss something. Come to find out, we had 20 years of time to do that, but the rush for everybody.
Where were you? Were you at BUDS at that point? Or no, I was already out. Were you already a SEAL?
Yeah, I was already a SEAL. I was in advanced training. Yep, just kind of standing by. And I remember the first tower fell as we were driving into work. I was with some of my buddies. And when we pulled into the front gate to show our IDs, the dude leaned out and he goes, "Congratulations, boys, y'all are going to war." And we were kind of like, "Yeah, all right." That was always the plan, I thought. You know, I didn't know.
Yeah.
And then we pulled in there and the Master Chief came walking out. And he had this look on his face like I'd never seen before. Because he was a badass dude, man. He was real cool. And they sat us down in there. And sure enough, we had all, you know, all the TVs on the wall. And they started playing that thing. And as we were watching it, the second one hit. Like while we were all sitting in there. And then the warrant officer pulled his head into the classroom. Just stuck his head in the classroom. He's like, "Get ready, you're going." That's all he said. And then I remember all the instructors, they didn't even want to finish training us. They wanted to go back to the teams.
Yeah, that no doubt.
Because they didn't want to miss
it. Yeah, anything. So I felt like I had missed the war. So I, you know, before 9/11, I had completed that training, or I'd completed the training with the Marines and had orders to Korea. And at the time, and this is like so way back machine, people are gonna laugh, but at the time, like, Korea was the hard assignment. Like, Korea was like, if you're going to go to war, it's going to be in Korea, you know? And so we were in Korea and we were like, holy crap, we have live ammo in our tanks. This is wild, you know? And because everybody else in the whole army, like, you know, you don't carry live ammo in your tanks. That's crazy. Why would you have high explosive rounds on board? But we had them. And so we thought, okay, well, this is real, you know? And then when 9/11 happened, and the war in Afghanistan started, and we started building up to war in Iraq, like, I was in Korea and I was commanding a tank company, and I was like, man, I missed the war, you know, I missed the war. My buddies are going to war, you know. Then the invasion happens in March of 2003, and I'm still in command of a tank company in Korea, and it's like, dang, you know, I trained all my life to go to war, and here everybody else gets to go, and I don't. And then spring of 04, I was getting ready to leave Korea to go to get a master's degree and go teach at West Point, because I'd gotten selected for that and it was a cool assignment. But I was like, crap, you know, everybody else has gone to war and here I am. And my boss and his boss came to me, and I was sitting in the mess hall for some reason. And they came to me and they said, "Hey, Dan, we're sending..." The other brigade was deploying. So there are two brigades at the time in Korea, and the other brigade was going, second brigade was going, and I was part of 1st Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division. And the other brigade was going, and so they said, "Hey," they said, "this is not a loyalty test." And what's funny about that statement is, like, if somebody says this is not a loyalty test, it's for sure a loyalty test,
right,
by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, they said, "This is not a loyalty test, but... we're sending your tank company and this other an alpha company from the same battalion. We're sending him. Do you want to go, or do you want to go on to grad school?" And I said, I quoted Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8 from the Bible. And I said, "Here am I, Lord, send me," you know? And so that was spring of 04. And we started a pretty intense training cycle for a couple of months. And then on August 7th, 2004, I landed in Kuwait, and we spent like a month in Kuwait, getting ready to get, or 3 weeks in Kuwait, getting ready to forward deploy into Iraq. And then by the end of August or early September, I don't remember exactly what day it was, we had our tanks on trucks and we rolled all the way into Ramadi, Iraq, which I know you're probably familiar with personally. And I know there were a whole bunch of SEALs operating there at the time. So
we got some skin in there.
Yeah. So we went to Ramadi and got there in early September of 2004.
Is that when you got hurt?
Yeah. So I was there. We took over our sector on like September 10th. So we had, that's when we got our actual, you know, like our sector is ours and the previous unit rotated off. And, we knew that we were in a super scary area. Like, I mean, Ramadi already was kind of famous for being a pretty scary area. And then one of my lieutenants was killed in action on September 14th. His name was Tyler Brown, and he was from Atlanta, Georgia. He'd been president of his class at Georgia Tech. Like, he was one of these high flying, like, he was definitely going to be somebody someday, you know? And he was shot and killed on September 14th. And that's kind of when I think it all hit home for all of us. Like, oh my gosh, like this is, you know, this is real. This is a scary place. But we had work to do, you know, so we keep operating and we keep doing our stuff. And then during the invasion of Fallujah in November of 2004, the second time we went into Fallujah. What I say is that the dumb bad guys stayed in Fallujah and died, and the smart bad guys came to Ramadi and lived. And so my tank was hit by a rocket propelled grenade on November 10th, which is the Marine Corps birthday, 2004. And it killed the soldier next to me. His name was Dennis Miller. He's from LaSalle, Michigan. Only child of Dennis Sr. and Kathleen, his mother. So it killed Dennis, hit him directly in the face and killed him instantly, and wounded me like really mildly. I had some shrapnel in my face and my arm, but it was basically returned to duty. I was back at work the next day.
What did if you don't mind me asking, did that thing go through the portal?
No, it didn't. So that's a great question. So tanks are pretty impervious to RPGs for the most part. The problem was that it was at night, and he was getting ready to fire there's a machine gun. There's an M240 at the loader's station, and there's a 50 cal at the tank commander station. And he was getting ready to fire the loader's 240 at the bad guys, because we were in this ambush, and we'd already killed some bad guys. We could see them through thermals, and we'd killed a couple of guys from the tank. And then he was getting ready to fire the 240 off the top at the same guys. And this RPG came off the roof of a mosque on the east side of Ramadi. And I saw it in flight. I saw it coming towards us. And I had the hatch half closed. Like, there's a thing called open protected where you can just see out this much, but you've got top cover on it. And I saw the RPG coming, and I ducked and said RPG. And it kind of skipped off the top of the tank and passed right through his head and killed him right away. It was dark in the tank, you know, because it was nighttime. But I remember I reached over and I like shook his head to see, like, he was sitting on the tank, and I was sitting on the floor of the tank, and I reached over and shook him to see if, like, is he okay? Like, is he conscious? You know, you're doing like an immediate check thing. And, you know, I don't want to be too graphic about it, but when I brought my hand back, it was very obvious that he'd been killed. And so I remember, man, like, we're driving back to the base camp, and I remember, like, the tank has like a blue dim light inside the tank. And I remember looking over and thinking, I'm looking at him. And the next day was Veterans Day, and I had that in my head. And I remember thinking, like, I know he's dead, but his parents don't know he's dead yet, you know, and they're going to find out on Veterans Day. Like, the Army is going to show up at their door on Veterans Day and tell them their son's been killed in action. It was pretty terrible. That's awful. So then, you know, you just have to go back to work, right? You just go back to work and you keep fighting and you keep doing your job. And then 2 months later to the day, I was hit by an IED outside of town. And that time I was in my Humvee. And I remember I like woke up on my back in the ditch, and my soldiers were already treating me. They're already like, you know, I looked down and I could see that I was already on a stretcher, but I could see like my body armor was all blown open, and I could see my guts. And I knew that that was not good, but my soldiers were treating my legs. And I remember asking them, like, hey, are my legs okay? I'll never forget it. They go, relax, or you're going to be fine. And relax, you're going to be fine is not a great answer to the question of, are my legs okay?
Yeah. Well, normally the guy spit out, hey, man, is my junk still there?
Yeah, well, so that's the next question I asked. It's actually funny you say that, because you've obviously, you know,
been in those kind of scenarios. I know that routine.
Yeah, my battalion XO, a guy named Major Reggie Cotton was there, and he's holding my hand, and he's talking to me. And trying to keep me out of shock and stuff while the medics treated my legs. And he goes, and I said, sir, I got to ask you something. He's like, yeah, anything, anything. And I go, you got to be honest with me. He's like, yeah, anything. And I go, are my cock and balls okay? And he goes, I don't know, man, let me check. And he goes down to where my pants are all blown open and stuff. And he comes back up to my head, and it was the happiest the phrase I've ever heard. He goes, yeah, man, they're dusty, but they look good to me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's so, a real question. Everyone spits that out. If you question. Get a funny medic, he'll be like, I think it's still there. I don't know. Does it always look like that?
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? It's so tiny I can barely see it. Yeah.
There was no chance it was going to hit it. Those guys have great sense of humors in that middle of that chaos, man. It helps.
Yeah, yeah. So my chaos was pretty bad, though, man. Like, the the explosive force had come right through my thigh. And I've actually got pictures of this, which I will not be sharing on the internet, because there was a combat photographer there and he took a bunch of pictures in the surgical suite, actually. But it looked like somebody had shoved a muddy football like right through my thigh. Like the bone was shattered and the femoral artery and vein were severed. And so it's a miracle that I'm alive, honestly. And I credit great medics and a great doctor and God's providence for keeping me alive. But at that point, my war was over, you know, like you don't come back from something like that. So I ended up spending a year in the hospital, basically a year in the hospital, like 6 months as an inpatient and another 6 months as an outpatient.
Where'd they put you?
And actually, what's funny about that is I'm pretty sure that it wasn't June of 05 when you were running for your life in the hills.
Yeah.
Because I remember hearing about that at the time. Like, I'm in the hospital. I remember hearing that there's this guy and, you know, we don't know if he's going to be recovered and all this stuff. So that's a little point of intersection in our lives. Like, I remember seeing your story on the news as it was kind of unfolding.
Where were you at?
I was at Walter Reed.
Oh, check.
Yeah, because all the very seriously injured guys would come back to Walter Reed unless they had head injuries or spinal cord injuries, in which case they would go to Bethesda, which is where they did head injury stuff.
Yeah, and the Burns went to San Antonio.
That's right. Yeah. I shouldn't neglect them because they're some of the more horrific injuries.
Oh man, those are
the bad ones for sure.
And I've seen when you were talking about that football sized hole, I've seen that one other time on your thigh.
Yeah,
like I couldn't
terrible. Believe
it. They kept the leg. You still have yours?
No. I'm a hip level amputee on the right side. It took about a week. They were able to kind of salvage it and kind of piece it back together at the combat surgical station, but then they got me back to Walter Reed, and I had rhabdomyolysis and I had infections and I had all this stuff going on, and they were like, yeah, the leg's got to come off. But I was unconscious all the time. I was unconscious for about 3 weeks. So my wife was there and she was an absolute rock star the whole time, but it was, the leg had to come off after about a week, and then I was unconscious for another couple of weeks after that.
What's waking up like?
You know, what's funny? People ask me sometimes, like, if I have any PTSD or anything like that. And I don't have bad dreams. I don't have anything like that. But when I was unconscious, I had horrible, horrible, horrible dreams. Like, I think your subconscious kind of like dredges up all the bad stuff. And so one of my bad nightmares was that my wife was cheating on me. And like, it wasn't like I just sort of knew that. I could see it in graphic detail. Like, I could see what was happening in my mind, you know. It was horrific. And another part of my dreams when I was unconscious was that, and this is stupid, but you know, you can't account for how your brain works, but that my dad had been body snatched by Al Qaeda. And so like, they were like sort of in his head, they were controlling him. And the only way I could free him from this was to kill him. And so one of my dreams was I had to kill my father with a pistol. And the worst part was that when those dreams would end, they would just loop. And so I'd get the dream again, and I'd get the dream again, and I'd get the dream again. And I only found out much, much later, like only like 5 years ago now, and we're 20 years post-injury, where one of my buddies who's a doctor was like, oh, yeah, that's called intensive care psychosis. Everybody gets it. And I was like, well, would have been great if I had known that a while back. So I had these horrible dreams when I was unconscious. But then once I became conscious, I remember I remember them saying, hey, your leg's been amputated and it's at the hip. And I was like, you know, that sucks. And I said, well, okay, how high is the other one? Because I thought that the other one in my dreams, the other one was gone too, but they're like, no, your other leg is fine, you know? And then I asked again about my genitals, and they were like, no, everything's fine, because in my dreams, my other leg was gone and my genitals were gone. So it was almost like a relief.
That's the most horrible thing ever.
Mm-hmm. It was horrible. Yeah, it was really horrible. And so then, you know, once I was conscious again, it was like, oh, okay, you know, now we've got a new mission, you know, team never quit, right? We've got a new mission. And the new mission is that I'm going to get better now. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to work my tail off to get better. And it was a long road, man. It was super long. I had a fractured skull. I had a broken neck. I had my whole abdomen was all open. Of course, the leg was missing. The other leg was had some. They'd done a vein graft, and so I had this big long scar from the like basically from my groin all the way down to my knee where they tried to. So anyway, it was like it was a long road. My pelvis was broken. I mean, it was pretty bad. But I was alive, and I could think, and I knew that eventually I was going to be okay. I had nerve damage to my hands. I couldn't lift my hands at all. Like I was in bad shape overall. But it was one of those things where like. Once you have a clear vision of what direction you're supposed to go, then you can just get, you know, you can get about the business of getting better. And for me, the business of getting better was, you know, just all the hard work of physical therapy and occupational therapy and on and on and on. And, you know, and now life is great, man. I'm doing great.
The prosthetic, you, when they first put that on there, what's that like?
Yeah. So with a hip level amputee, I don't wear a prosthetic anymore. I just use crutches, but, and have for about 5 years, but for about 10, 15 years, I would wear a prosthetic basically every day. And, the way that a prosthetic for a hip level amputee works is you first put on this, like, think of like silicone kind of underwear that basically encases that side where the hip is. And then that thing has a strap on it and then you have like this carbon fiber kind of bucket thing that goes over it and then straps on. And then you have a belt that you wear under your clothes that sort of keeps the thing tight to your body. And I was pretty good at walking, and it took a long time. I tell people it's sort of like learning to ride a unicycle. Yeah. Like it's pretty hard, but once I got it, I was able to do it, and I didn't use canes or crutches or anything like that when I had my leg on. After a while, like for a while, I had two crutches that I would use, and then I had two canes, and then I went down to one cane, and then eventually I could just walk, you know, any place. But, you know, I know most hip level amputees choose not to wear prosthetics. And the reason is kind of like, for me, at least, I was more mobile and comfortable without a leg on. And then I'm like, well, why am I doing this? Like, am I doing this so that you don't feel like, so that people in the grocery store don't stare at me? Cause that's a dumb reason, you know? And so now I just, you know, I'm perfectly happy the way I am. And sometimes little kids stare at me and their moms are like, you know, whatever. And it's kind of funny, but it's just my life, man. And like, I think that's part of adjusting to living life with a disability is saying, okay, well, you know, what's the best way to do this for myself and for my family? And for me, I don't use a prosthetic anymore, but for those who do, good on them. But yeah, it's hard. It's really hard.
So how'd they rotate you out of the Army?
So actually I stayed in the Army for a long time. So I told you before that I'd been accepted to teach at West Point, and the way West Point does it, and I think the Naval Academy does the same thing and the Air Force Academy, but they pick the people they want, and then they send them to get the degrees that they need.
Oh, that's great.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had already been accepted to teach. And so when I was in the hospital still, I called the person who would eventually be my boss at West Point and said, hey, you know, bad news. I got my leg blown off. And, you know, can I still come and teach? And they were like, yeah, sure. No problem. You know, take the time you need to get better and do that. And I actually was able to start my master's degree at the University of Georgia a year to the day after I got hurt. So January 10th of 2006 was a year to the day. And that's when I started my master's. And so this is actually kind of funny. So a year and a half later, fast forward a year and a half to spring of 07. And that's when the big Walter Reed scandal happened. Yeah. And so the White House called me on my cell phone, and this is like flip phone, is before iPhones came out. And they called me on my cell phone and said, hey, would you consider coming to the White House to be in charge of our veterans stuff? And I was like, sure, absolutely, you know. So by summer of 07, I was barely 2 years post injury, and then at that point I was at the White House doing veterans policy for the White House Domestic Policy Council is what it's called. So I got to be, so I went from like user level wounded warrior, you know, just the guy in the hospital bed, to being the guy whose office is like overlooking the West Wing from the building across the street. And actually, another point of connection between us is when you came to the White House to get your Navy Cross. I think I was there. I was either in the room or I remember it because I was like right. I was on the complex, and I was like, "Oh, that's pretty cool. That guy's pretty cool."
That's awesome.
So, yeah. Small anyway, world. It's a super small world, huh?
Yeah, that's very cool.
Well, nobody get. I mean, that's a great perspective that you have coming from that one straight to the other.
And then to be able to teach and the kids
that's the coolest thing, I think.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get my kid interested in going to one of the academies, breakthrough. And I don't care which one it is.
We're sending
him. I'd be happy to talk to him.
Yeah. We're sending him to the Naval Academy.
Oh, you might be the new uncle. I'm like, hey, bro, I need you to get this kid in here.
Yeah, man. I'm happy to talk to him.
We're sending him to the baseball camp. The
academies are great. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed teaching there. So let me fast forward. So I get my master's and then I go to the White House for a year. And then at the end of my time at the White House, the University of Georgia said, hey, do you want to come back for a PhD? And I was like, totally. So I called West Point and said, hey, they want to bring me back for a PhD. Is that cool? And West Point was like, yeah, totally. So instead of getting, I'm paraphrasing heavily, right? But instead of getting there getting to West Point summer of 2007 as like a brand new major or something, I got to West Point in summer of 2011 with a PhD and was promoted to a lieutenant colonel a year later. And then I taught there for like 5.5 years. And then I retired at 20 years of service in January of 2017 is when I finally retired from the Army.
Did you get to live in one of the houses on base on the campus?
Yeah. Yeah. For a while. And then we moved off post because, honestly, like it felt a little like living in a fishbowl, you know, where everybody's watching you all the time. Cause you get like other military people around you. And so we moved off post and had a great time, but yeah, West Point's a great place. No doubt.
That freaking view y'all have, man, over the river and especially when everything's, the leaves are changing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice.
Cause those dismal walls scare everybody. I remember in high school when you hear about the academies, especially West Point, the walls and everything, it's like, man, I don't know. It looks like But as soon as you get in there and get to see that, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like a prison. I always tell people, I think the Naval Academy is the prettiest one. I think the Air Force Academy looks silly with their, like, you know, it's made in the 1950s, right? So that's when everybody thought we would be living in Jetsons land now. And so I call their architectural style 50s faux modern, you know, because it's like all modern. Pointy, whatever. And, I like that. But
Colorado. The Naval Academy
is gorgeous. Yeah, but Colorado's great, of course. Yeah, so,
and it's tucked up next to that mountain.
Yeah, the mountain's nice. Yeah, no doubt about it.
But you're right. The Naval Academy, man, it's beautiful walking
it's
around
pretty,
there.
Yeah. Yep. No doubt.
So our little one is going, he's just turned 14, and he's going to go to the baseball camp there this summer, and we're excited about that.
That's great. Yeah. Are you guys going to come out and visit him? Because I'm in Alexandria, Virginia, so you guys could maybe stop by and we could have lunch or something. That'd be fun.
Yeah, Hunter's actually the one that's going to be bringing him up. And because I have to be in Mexico and Marcus has a thing.
A wedding.
Yeah. But there's a bunch of stuff going on at that time. But Hunter is going to be bringing Axe and Addie up and he's going to take Addie golfing while Axe is in baseball camp.
Fun. That's fun.
So, yeah. But yeah, we love the academies. I've never been to West Point, but Marcus has and he loves it.
Yeah. I had a great time there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a pretty place.
So you rolled out you discharged from West Point as a teacher. Then what do you do?
Yeah, so I actually was invited. So that was when Trump got elected the first time, and so I ended up in the Trump administration at the U.S. Department of Labor doing veteran employment work there, and I stayed there for about a year and a half, and then I went on to be a professor at American University in DC and did that for a couple of years. And in 2020, I ran for office in Virginia and lost. I ran for US Senate in Virginia, which is a pretty, pretty major step for somebody who hadn't been involved in politics before, but I was a Republican nominee for US Senate in Virginia in 2020 and got a ton of votes, but ended up coming up a little short. And then I was able to help Governor Youngkin get elected. He asked me to be in charge of his like coalition's effort when he was running for governor. And so I did that during the campaign and then spent 2 years as the commissioner of the Department of Veterans Services for Virginia. So like think think of like Secretary of the VA at the national level. The Commissioner of Veterans Services at the state level is kind of that same function. And that was a great job. It was super fun. And then I left that job about a year and a half ago and went to look for a company to buy. And I have some investors and a loan from the bank. And I bought a small defense contracting company. And I've been doing that for now about 6 months. But you also
wrote a book.
It's fun. Yeah, that's right. So the book is called Wounding Warriors. It's on Amazon. It's on Audible too. And the Audible book is, I actually did the Audible book myself.
Okay, good.
But the central premise of the book Wounding Warriors is that, oh, here's the cover. There we go.
Nice. I like it.
Look at that. So the central premise of the book is basically that our national level disability policy is a disaster when it comes to veterans, and not in the way that many people think. Like, a lot of people think, oh yeah, we're not generous enough with veterans. And the truth is, in a lot of ways, the generosity that we do have for veterans is actually too much and in the wrong direction, because it incentivizes all the wrong behaviors. So for example, like when people think of like a disabled veteran, what they're thinking of is, you know, somebody with an amputation or burns or a brain injury or even post-traumatic stress. What they're not thinking of is things like ringing ears and, you know, low back pain and all those things. And what it does is, and you've probably seen this too, where way too many veterans get this idea that you know, we talked earlier, actually, in this conversation, we talked earlier about like purpose and meaning and value.
Yep.
And how those are really powerful ways to prevent people from, you know, self-harm and all kinds of other negative behaviors. But the veterans disability system actually encourages people to see themselves as their sickest selves and to exaggerate how sick they are in order to get paid. So for example, there's a program called Individual Unemployability. And Individual Unemployability is this VA program that will compensate a veteran whose rating isn't 100%. It will compensate them at the 100% rate, provided that they don't work. Well, so here's the problem with that, right? Is that especially for men, the same thing is true of women to some degree. But especially for men, we get our like purpose and value from our position in society relative to our employment.
100%.
So if somebody says,
that's a respect thing. Like trying to exactly.
So, so when somebody says, what do you do for a living? When you're in the military, you say, oh, I'm a SEAL. Oh, I'm a this, I'm a that, right? When you leave the military, the same thing, people say, hey, what do you do for a living? And you say, you know, I run a business. You know, I'm an author, I'm this, I'm that. But it's all about your employment. And so what this VA program does is strips that central pillar away from a veteran's identity. And so now the only thing that guy can do is identify as a disabled veteran, right? And you can sort of personalize this, right? So let's say some guy's 24 years old. He wants to meet a nice girl to get married to. And he goes to church or whatever, wherever he's meeting people. And the first question that society asks that guy is like, what do you do for a living? And if his answer is, I'm a disabled veteran, well, that's not a living. That's not valuable, right? That's a rearward facing negative identity. That's not a positive forward facing identity. And so it's that program like strips people of their connection to society. And then we all act surprised when, you know, when a veteran goes in the garage and, you know, gets out the shotgun. And the problem is that we caused it, like we paid for it.
Yeah.
And that's a very controversial view. You know, the data bears it out and the book really lays out the case in a very careful way. But and most veterans, I think, especially high functioning veterans, most veterans like see it and they know it, but it was kind of scary for me actually to put this book out there, because it kind of is like the third rail of American politics. We're not supposed to question veterans when they say that they can't work. We're not supposed to question veterans when they say they're disabled, but there's so much fraud in the system. That's part one. And part two is the system itself disincentivizes wellness and positivity, and it causes people to quit and to disengage from society. And then when they, you know, cycle into alcoholism and depression and eventually suicide, like, who should be surprised? We shouldn't be surprised. It's right there in the system. And that's what the book is about. And, it's very carefully researched, and Jim Mattis wrote the cover blurb for it. So you can, so it's not like a, it's not like some under the radar thing.
Yeah, you're talking about the dark side of the force.
That's right.
Yeah, what exactly? I mean,
have you seen that from your buddies? Like, where guys are like,
I know exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That's why I call it the dark side. No one talks about it. Yeah. We all see it. We know it's there. And the drugs are the worst for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, you're putting them in that environment's one thing, but then when you dope them up, that's what PTSD stands for: pissed off, tired, stoned, and drunk. I mean, you just can't. There's a rationale that comes with that, and the deeper you go into the darkness, the harder it is to get back. And then
that's right.
You could have two guys sitting on a couch, and one is in hell and one is in heaven. And it all has to do with the thought process and the drugs and everything that just keep perpetuating that. Because they once they say, well, I'm fine, then you don't get paid. But
that's
then
right.
Some of the guys that's right. are hurt enough to where they actually, there's something wrong, they can't work, so they just take it all the way. We all know yeah. who they are. Anybody who's been on the line and in the service with the uniform knows immediately who they are when they show up. We just don't say nothing.
Yeah.
Especially and to us, because in my view, there's a difference between a citizen and a civilian. American has civilians. They've never served in a uniform in any type, whether it's a mailman all the way up to the military, firefighter, first responders. And then you actually have citizens. And citizens are the service members around here that actually the saddle up, put the uniform on, and put the work in. And those are two different types of people. And you won't dare talk about a citizen in front of a civilian. We just don't do that.
Interesting.
We just don't do that.
Yeah, I like that perspective. That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, and the other part about this, it's basically welfare. The whole system is basically welfare. And everybody knows that welfare disincentivizes or discourages thriving. But when a veteran does it, we're all supposed to turn the other way and turn a blind eye to it and say, oh, that's not what it is. And that is what it is. If a guy is maximizing his illness to get paid by his fellow citizens, it's no different than going to your neighbor's house and ripping through her purse for cash. It's the same exact thing. It's just that you're using the color of law and hiding behind the American flag to do it. And I just think it's time that veterans, you know, like you and, you know, I mean, you know, Jay Redmond is a friend of mine and he's been good about this. And Andy Stumpf has talked about it. And, you know, people are talking about it, but I think the story needs to get out there even more that this is a real problem, and it's going to have to be veterans who sort of stand up and say, enough is enough. We are not welfare queens. We are, to your argument, we're citizens. We're not civilians. And we got to work for it. We got to work for the society we want.
Oh, that's when you'll see that now there's a transition of power going on. Well, we're coming into our own. We've been gone fighting 20 years of war. So the baby boomers have been running everything. Well, now we're back. The wars are over and everyone's kind of getting clear-headed and we're kind of getting back in step. A lot of guys are finding their purpose of what they want to do in life. You see that kind of that slow is smooth, smooth is fast. It's not happening overnight. And then it'll take guys like Red. I mean, look at if anybody should be able to milk the system, it's Jay. And he does.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, for guys. And you. You know, yeah. I'm talking about them guys and girls when they roll up and you're like, whoa, man, the hardest hits, they don't even touch it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what I always tell people is like, imagine yourself walking as a veteran, right? Imagine yourself walking up to some random civilian and listing your disabilities, right? Listing them from one to N, however many there are. And if you can do that with a straight face, and you can say to that civilian, hey, you owe me because of these disabilities, and you list them one to N, then probably that's, you know, morally, you're probably in pretty good shape, right? But if it makes you ashamed to walk up to that civilian and that citizen and say he owes you money because of these conditions, then probably you're doing the wrong thing. It's like a really quick sort of azimuth check, if you will, for whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And when you look at their reports, right, the average veteran with a disability isn't some guy in a wheelchair who got his legs blown off. The average veteran with a disability is a guy who says his ears are ringing and there's no test for that, right? Or a guy who says he has PTSD and he can't really explain why he does, but he knows that he's mentally ill, or he says he's mentally ill, and so he's getting paid for that. And it's like, are we doing the right thing? You know, the VA pays, the VA pays, it's a 50% disability if somebody has a CPAP machine, if they use a CPAP machine for sleep apnea. And it's like, you know what? Sleep apnea is for, is when people get fat, and it's not really about, I mean, it can be, there can be some physiological conditions that cause it, but it's not a disability. It's a condition. You should get it treated. You should get a CPAP machine if you need one. You should use it, right? But it's not a disability. And so we should stop pretending like it's 50% disabling. That's crazy, you know? And I talked to Congressman Crenshaw about this, I don't know, 2 years ago, something like that. And I was on his podcast, and his eye, losing an entire eye all by itself is only a 30% disability. But a guy who says he has sleep apnea and uses the CPAP machine is 50. I mean, the system is crazy. Yeah. And, yeah, you know, I'm hoping that at some point somebody will engage with serious reform on it, but it's going to take members of Congress. It's going to take a president who's willing to engage on it. And, you know, so far we haven't had that. So the, you know, the fraud kind of goes on and on.
So in your book, do you lay out a solution?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all about, and the last chapter is really the one where we sort of lay out a way of thinking. And I've got a co-author, a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, really good dude. Anyway, but the last chapter is really in my voice. And what we talk about in that chapter is like, what we need to do is reorient the whole system towards, like I talked about earlier, towards employment and towards thriving and towards change its goals from seeing how much money people can get to see how good of outcomes they can get. And there's some action steps in there. For example, we ought not to label somebody disabled until they've gone through the full rehabilitation process, right? We ought to have incentives to stay in the workforce. We have to have incentives for veterans to stay healthy. So, you know, as a silly example, or it's not policy yet. I wish it were, but like, imagine the case where if you go in for your annual physical, and if a veteran is within some normal BMI range, right? They're not fat, whatever. They can get paid for that, right? Instead of paying people to fake disabilities, why don't we pay them for the outcomes we want? Because, you know, a public policy, I'll put it this way, like a public policy bumper sticker is, if you want more of something, incentivize it. If you want less of something, tax it, right? So right now we incentivize illness and we get surprised when we have illness. What we ought to do is incentivize wellness and incentivize thriving instead of incentivizing negative things. And you'd get more of that, but it's all laid out in the book, which is on Audible. It's on Amazon. It's on Audible. It's right there. You can just pick up a copy, and I'm sure the guys will, Hunter will link it for us in the description and stuff.
You do agree with paying out people that, like you, do have missing limbs and missing eye and, you know, essentials that we were born with and that was lost in war. There's got to be some sort of, not incentive, but payback for that.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. You know, some things, for one thing, our veterans' healthcare system needs probably a lot more resources, right? So maybe it's the case that if you serve in combat or if you serve in the military for some period of time, maybe you should just have healthcare given to you regardless of your disability level. Right now, the only way to get healthcare from the VA is if you also apply for disability from the VA. So you have to go through the disability wormhole in order to get healthcare. And so a lot of veterans will go through that disability system only in order to get healthcare. What we should be doing probably is just giving veterans healthcare. You know, you've earned it, now you get it, right? Regardless of disability, you can get healthcare from the VA. That's one way that you could ensure a life or help have a life of wellness for people without paying them cash payments. But for some injuries, yeah. I mean, you know, I talked about the sort of explaining to some random citizen why you're getting paid for something. I think if you walk up to somebody and you say, hey, you know, I get a monthly payment from the VA because I got, you know, 80% burns over my body, or I got shot 14 times like Jay did, or how many times it was, or, you know, I got my leg blown off or whatever. I think the average citizen is going to be like, absolutely. You know, that's fine. We're happy to pay you for that. But, you know, I've got the VA's annual benefits report right here. And the number one condition, there are 6 million people getting disability compensation, and 3.2 million of them are getting it for tinnitus, ringing of the ears. And it's really funny because, yeah, okay, like we make jokes about it in veteran circles, like my ears actually are ringing right now. But the truth is, it's not a disability. Even if your ears are ringing, it's not a disability. And
because you can still hear.
You can still hear. And there's no test for it. So the only test for these people is the doctor says, are your ears ringing? And you say, oh, doc, they're ringing terrible. And you get 10% disability for that. It's crazy. You know, the second biggest one is limitation of flexion of the knee with 2 million people. And it's like, well, probably your knees hurt because you're 60, you know? Your knees don't hurt because you were in the army in your 20s. Your knees hurt because you're 60, and we live in a world with gravity and bodies wear out. You know, like, this isn't weird. So reorienting the system towards helping people with substantial disabilities get back on their feet and get into the labor force and providing for themselves, that's what we ought to be striving for, not, you know, sitting around the VFW comparing disability ratings with people. I know it's a complex, it's a pretty complex argument, and the book really lays it out carefully.
Yeah.
But it kind of can sound a little heartless, but think about it this way. If one of your kids, let's say you have an 8-year-old, right? And the 8-year-old says, hey dad, hey mom, I want to have candy bars for dinner. Are you being kind to that child by saying, oh, okay, yeah, you can have a Snicker bar for dinner? No, you're being cruel. Now, from the child's perspective, you're the best parent ever because you let me have candy bars for dinner, right? But it's not best for the child. And so that's why we say, okay, well, we might have dessert some days, but we're going to actually eat our dinner. We're going to have a balanced meal because we care about, we love our kid enough to give them the food they need, right? But the system that we have now incentivizes all the wrong things and does it from a position of, you know, caring or love. Mm-hmm. But I think that system, because it pays people to be sick and to view themselves as sick and broken and worthless, I think that system is driving the suicide crisis, not preventing it. Mm-hmm. I think it's making people's lives worse, not better. And so we ought to have a society and a veteran system that helps people, even those with very serious disabilities, helps them get into and stay in the workforce, helps them get into and stay in stable relationships, helps them get off of drugs and alcohol and all those things. So it's really about caring for veterans the right way rather than just throwing checks at them and hoping that those, you know, I have a friend who calls them green dollar bandages, that those green dollar bandages are going to make their lives better, because they're not. As a matter of fact, in a lot of cases, those green dollar bandages make their lives worse, not better. And that's a pretty hard pill to swallow, but I think it's really necessary for our society to kind of look at it and grapple with some really hard truths.
It's definitely a conversation to have of reworking the system, because it's there's a lot of fraud, like you said, a lot of medical fraud, because there is incentive behind it. So it's definitely
too many organizations involved in it too. Everything gets mixed up, and the veterans get stuck in there and get abused by the whole system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when I first got to Athens, Georgia, I went to for my master's degree. I was like, well, you know, I lost a leg, so I guess I have a disability now. And you know, I've heard of DAV. I'm going to go to the DAV meeting, you know. And so I go to the local chapter of the DAV, and I'm there's a whatever monthly meeting or whatever, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking around, and I'm talking to some guys after the meeting, and I think there were like 20 people in the room, like 15 of them had never served in combat. I was the only one in the room who'd been wounded at all. And the first thing they were doing was all these guys were like, hey, what's your disability rating? Can we get it higher for you? Can whatever. And I was like, I was so disgusted by the whole thing that I just like walked out and never went back in. Because it's all the wrong things. Why would we be asking people what their disability rating is before we ask them if they need help getting a job? Yeah. Right? Who cares what your disability rating is? Let's get somebody employed so they don't need the money, so they can provide for themselves and love their families that way.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be a big one to tackle.
Yeah, that'll be a big one.
Oh yeah.
It's
tough.
Yeah. I think there are definitely people that deserve it, like you. I think you deserve it. I think there's tons of people that deserve to be compensated for what they experienced in war, but there's so many people that, like you said, have never served in combat that are taking advantage of the system. It's a big one to tackle. Good luck to you.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, that's a big one. I mean, I think that what I'm doing in my life is I'm providing for my own family. You know, I'm providing for the families of the people who work for the company that I own. You know, I'm trying to do the best I can every day because I've got 92 employees and their families who are counting on me to be the best boss I can possibly be. And so, you know, that's what I'm focused on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, someday if I dip my toe back into politics, then, you know, somebody's going to pull up this podcast and be like, oh, you said that. No, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm saying we should take care of veterans the right way,
right?
Not turn them into welfare queens.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's a complex, it's definitely a complex and controversial argument. I wouldn't expect Morgan to campaign on this for his next, for his reelection campaign.
The most important thing is getting the veterans what they need. Plain and simple.
That's right.
Bottom line. But not to hit them with something that will drag them down into darkness that they can't get out of. And most of them don't want to be down in there anyways.
That's right.
It's no fault of their own. Because they're designed to take orders. And when they, especially the guys who are coming later in life, they walk into that system that's already like that, and they get hit with all that stuff. Let me tell you something. When I was laying in that hospital bed, tubes hanging in my body, in a freaking coma, is when they introduced that poison to me. And my weakest moment is when they put me on that stuff and I got addicted. By no fault of my own. And that happens to a lot of these guys. And when we get out, you and I were talking earlier. I was like, man, you should never get out. Like, you never get out. Like, when you do your service, something's wrong with you, your butt needs some medical attention, go to the hospital, get it done, and then come back out. There's got to be a way we can do this. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a way we can do it, for sure. Because the American people already wrote us a check. They're like, hey, guys go to war. I think it was back in the Civil War, whenever they came online. It's like, hey, you guys, you do this for us, we'll take care of you when you get back.
That's right.
And I think that's what they're trying to do. The American people will always step up and do that. And they don't care. I mean, they don't even think they care if they abuse it. They don't. The people who do care are the other veterans. Like, hey, man, because it leads to bad things. And we got guys and girls killing themselves left over right, and you know that's the reason.
That's right.
And we're trying to fix that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going after. And in order to do that, man, we got to ask hard questions. Like, what's this? Why is this happening? And then we have to evaluate that. And we'll get it. I mean, you're already starting it. You're leading the charge just by bringing the question up. And it was a question everybody already know it exists. So it's just one of those things to pull it into the light. And that's an honorable thing, man. Good on you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Thank you for continuing service. I mean, that's the one thing that we always talk about is, you know, to keep your spirits up, you have to always serve, whether it's back to veterans or your community or whatever it is, just having some sort of purpose of service is so important to our mental health.
Yeah, especially the Almighty whipped your ass like he did for this reason. Like, you got to know that. Like, you had to go get your qualifications to stand in front of all of us before you could stand in front of us and talk about all this. And no one could come at you.
Well, they do anyway. You know, it's funny. If you throw a stone into a pack of dogs, the one that yelps is the one that got hit.
I know exactly dogs, what you're talking about with that.
Right. But the ones who really come after me and are like, oh, you're trying to save veterans. No, the ones who come after me are the ones who are getting, you know, they've got tinnitus and they're willing to fake PTSD because it's easy to fake. They're willing to, you know, fake, you know, all these things. those are the ones who really, really hate this argument because they're going to be exposed and because they're liars and people don't like the truth to be said to them if the truth is that they're doing the wrong thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so the ones who come after me it happens and I've seen it and every once in a while I get death threats and stuff, but I don't care. You can't kill me.
Gosh.
It's fine.
Crazy.
Hell, I didn't even know tonight is you could get money for that. My ears ring is so bad, bro. It could be its own radio station.
I know.
I know it's a real thing. I just didn't know you could get paid for it. And there's no test for it.
Marcus was the world's worst person going through those med boards or whatever. Cause he's like, oh, I'm fine. And I'm like, babe, you have to tell them the truth. Like, you have to tell them the surgeries that you've had, all of the different, you know, at the time he was still having like a surgery a year. I'm like, you have to explain what you're going through. Don't make anything up. But he would just act like nothing was wrong. And
because in the teams, man, and we're going through training, you're taught not to go to medical.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
If you go into medical,
because you're a sick bay ranger or whatever. Yeah.
You don't want that handle at all, man. You don't want to go anywhere. And I was a medic, for God's sakes.
Mm-hmm. We were married.
When I got out of the Army, when I was going through that process as I was getting out, the VA like claims guy that was working on my packet was like, hey, he goes, you know, he goes, I'm going to list all the things here for you. And he's like, okay, amputation, you know, like whatever. And he's listing the real stuff. And then he gets to the part where it's like a judgment call, right? He goes, well, what about your brain injury? And I go, well, I don't have a brain injury. He said, well, you were knocked unconscious, right? And I go, I was unconscious for 3 weeks. He goes, well, then you have a brain injury. And he goes, and I can get you paid for that. And I'm like, bro, I don't have a brain injury. I go, I don't have any symptoms of a brain injury. I've gotten a master's and a PhD since I got hurt. I don't, you know, lash out at my wife. Like, I'm fine. I don't have a brain injury. He goes, you're not understanding me. He's like, I can get you paid for that. And I go, you're not understanding me because I'm not going to lie. And he's like, he didn't like that because this was a guy who, he was, and there were a couple other examples like that. He was trying to get me to exaggerate. Like, he was coaching me to exaggerate the severity of my conditions. And eventually I just said, look, man, here's what I'm going to claim. I go, I will claim only things that were caused by combat. I'm not going to claim anything that wasn't. So if you're going to tell me that, you know, whatever, and he did not like that at all. Mm-hmm. But for me, that was where the moral line was. Like, Am I gonna write down that I got my leg blown off and then, you know, get a check from the VA for that? Sure, no problem. Yeah, to your point, Melanie, right? But am I gonna fake stuff? Am I gonna exaggerate the degree, you know, the severity of something in order to get a higher paycheck? Absolutely not. Yeah. I'm not gonna do it because my morality prevents me from doing it. And if more people would be like that, then we wouldn't even need to have to reform the system, I think.
And more doctors to be on your side for truth.
Right.
We were married for 8 or 9 years before I even knew what TRICARE was.
Bro, I never went into any of that. Nothing.
He doesn't take advantage of any of the like stuff. And I was complaining about health insurance to somebody because I was paying for private health insurance.
Oh my.
And they said, why aren't you on TRICARE? And I was like, oh, I married Marcus after he got out. We're not qualified for any of that. And she goes, no, you are. And she goes, hilarious. Is Marcus on TRICARE? I was like, no, I'm paying for his Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Oh, golly.
For 8 or 9 years because no one told me any of the stuff. I had no idea. And he never would look into any of that. So, yeah, we're definitely on the other side of the spectrum of what you're talking about.
That's funny.
Bro, they were giving me Social Security. And I opened up because I was like, I don't need that. So I opened up a checking account and wired it in there where I couldn't touch it. And it was well over 100 grand.
Holy cow. After years.
Yeah, after a few years, it was well over 100 grand. And then they came looking for it. Yeah. I was like, I got it right here for you, man. I've been waiting on you.
They came back for it.
Yeah, and so I gave it to them. And then a few months later, they'd call back. Well, you know, they kept sending me checks. They kept sending me the checks.
Like paper checks?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had a wire transferred in there. And then they call again. I'm like, I got it waiting right here. I never touched it. Here you go. It's all yours. Cancel me, please. That's cancel funny. My
So you must have did you retire medically after all that?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Okay. So you retired medically with like what 12 years of service, something like that?
Nine. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool.
Because they would measure my
people,
scars.
A lot of people don't know, you know, the TRICARE works for retirees, no matter why they retired. That's I'm sorry you had to waste all that money.
No.
Medically retired.
It's all good.
Yeah.
But just to go into the whole system, like I would cancel that. I was like, man, please just take me off your list. I don't need that money.
Yeah,
and then they keep sending it. This happened like 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
And the ladies were really nice about it. They're like, baby, we don't know. Yeah. I'm like, if you just.
You're like, stop sending me money.
Yeah. Please stop sending me money funny. And drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they kept coming. So I was like, all right, cool. And if I eventually we got squared away. Yeah. I just never needed it.
Yeah.
They don't send it anymore.
Now, maybe, well, that's good. Maybe in 20 years, if you guys want to start sending it to me again when I can't.
that's when we're actually retirement age. So yeah. we get the Social Security payments at that point, I guess.
When these knees finally do give out and I absolutely can't hear, besides that damn ringing in my head, then we'll talk.
That's funny.
Well. But I know we can fix it. Mm-hmm. I just don't think we've addressed it. That's the problem.
No, nobody's addressed it.
Yeah,
because the number of the kind of people who are willing to address it and who can do it, like I mean, I'm like one of like 5 people, right? Because I have a PhD in policy. I've got 2 Purple Hearts and 1 leg, and I'm willing to talk about this stuff publicly. Most everybody else, like you could address it because you have a Navy Cross, you're famous, right? You could address it, but the number of people who can address it is like only a few people could get away with saying even some of the things I've said on this podcast. And I've been pretty careful here actually. And the book lays it out and it's right there in black and white for anybody who wants to engage with the argument.
Yeah. You know, to be brutally honest, the reason I don't address it is because I don't want to get in anybody's way.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And just to complete honesty, and is that right? Probably not. Maybe I should be the one that steps up and do it. But just between me and all my brothers, I just wouldn't do that. And that probably makes me a bad person.
Nah. Nah. I mean,
not because of sister's butt, man. I'm the one that can step in and fix it.
Nah.
Your brother can.
I mean, your brother is a congressman.
Yeah, I'm gonna put it on him.
look, I mean, like, yeah, if you're providing for your family and you're taking care of your business and you're a member of your community and you're being a good citizen to your point earlier, which I love and I'm gonna adopt. Like, if you're doing those things, you're already doing enough. You don't need to do any more, mm-hmm. unless you feel called to do it. And in my case, like, I saw it, I knew what it was gonna do to me if I went down that route. And so I chose not to go down the route. And I'm warning people like, hey, don't go down that route. It's going to make you sicker and poorer.
Mm-hmm. I get it, man. Yeah. It's tough. That's another one of those life things, man. Like that you saw it and it caught your crosshairs.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I could see it in my peripheral. I'm moving beside it and I haven't shifted over to it. I know it exists, man. And I know I have the key to get in there and do something about it, man. But I guess I totally, I didn't want to get in any of my brother's ways, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's weird.
I get it.
I feel kind of shameful about it now, but.
But Morgan can.
But now I got my brother, so he can take full benefit, and he can freaking yell at his ass all day long.
Well, I'll get your address, and I'll send you a copy of the book, and I'll send one to Morgan as well if you give me his address.
Sign that thing for me, will you, so I can put it in my library?
Yeah. Absolutely. Of all course right. I will. You got to promise to read it, though, or at least listen to it
absolutely.
On Audible.
We'll read it. You can just send both to us, and we'll get it to Morgan.
Yeah, I'll pass it over.
Right down the street.
I mean, he's 10 miles up the road. I'll drive him, drop one off in his office.
Oh,
we'll be up there for the baseball game.
Yeah, we'll be up there in 2 weeks.
Oh, cool. When is that?
It's June 12th.
June 12th.
No.
Nice,
I'm
dude.
Sorry.
I'd love to come.
June 11th.
Shake your hand. That'd be fun. I'd like to see you guys.
Yeah, we'll meet up at the game.
June 11th.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's great having you.
Yeah,
thank you for sharing
thank
your
you so
story.
Much. Thanks for your service and for everything that you do too, man. That's it's a powerful testimony.
As much as
yeah, back at you guys.
You've been hit.
Back at you for sure.
Going. All right, man. God bless you.
All right, God bless you guys.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.